Accession number 29238, reel 11.
Mr. Wiggum, reel 11.
And with that, you've got the same size mug of tea. Again, no sugar or milk. Just tea. And you went out to do a morning's work on that. At midday, we got the same size pot of dry rice. And if you were lucky, you might get a little bit of dried fish to go with it. And another mug of tea. Out on the line, they made tea morning and afternoon. I don't know whether I mentioned this in one of the previous ones. In 40-gallon oil drums, the Japs made this tea. And they used to put big chunks of rock salt into the tea. That sounds awful, I know. But you never tasted it. Because the way you were sweating, and that's why they did it, the way you were sweating, you were losing so much from your system. You could rub your hand up your arm and feel the grit. That you never tasted this rock salt. In fact, sometimes if we could get hold of a bit, you know, a little bit of free time we had, lying perhaps reading a book, we'd break it up like bits of sweets beside us and just sit eating salt, you know. And you just didn't taste it as salt. But that had to sustain you until you finally got back to camp at night. And then you got another little mug of dry rice, and perhaps 3/4 of a one of what pasta stew. And if you had a couple of little squares of vegetable floating in it, you were lucky. If it was a bit of meat, well, it was VE day, you know. And that was our rations for working until the Japs said stop. On this blooming railway.
How many hours were you working a day?
Well, we went out, as far as I can remember, about 8:30 in the morning, I think. And if it was a normal, straightforward day, we'd finish perhaps about 5:30 in the afternoon. This was a speedo on, things were back a bit, well, you could work till any time the Japs said. But,
what sort of work were you doing at this?
The same time? The same building as Bloomin' Embankment with the picks and shovels and stretchers, you know. Monotonous Bloomin' business. And at any rate, we staggered out. I say staggered because my legs were like balloons. By the time I got back at night with this beriberi, no reflexes at all in them, and they were not reasonably normal size when I went out in the morning after a night's so-called sleep, but I hadn't been working long before they started to blow up, you know. And then one night, to our horror, our regimental sergeant major appeared in the tent after night, lights out. And the sergeant said, "Yes, sir." He said, "In the morning, before reveille, take 3 men down to the river and don't let anybody anywhere near it. We've got cholera." Oh, I think you can hear our hearts hit our boots, you know. And then it started. Well, the Japs were terrified of cholera. So were we, mine. I'm not saying we were any braver. But they'd had a bad bashing with cholera in China, the Japanese army, apparently. And they were terrified of it. And everything relaxed as a result. And our medical officers took immediate advantage of it, and on the first day, instead of 12 sick in the hospital, which was allowed, there were 120, and the chaps never said boo, you know. But of course, everything got even worse than before, because you could only use water that had been boiled, and there was a limit to what facilities they had. So we got one water bottle full of boiled water per day, and that was for everything, for washing and all the rest of it. And at meal times, the quantities were reduced even more, because they just didn't have it, you know. And the blooming monsoons were beginning to ease a little bit by then.
What effect did the monsoon and the climate have on you?
Well, you know, you were just soaked when you went out to work. And at that particular camp, when it was intense, the blooming tents leaked. And if you had any bedding, and I was lucky to have a blanket, and the other bits of clothes I had, my shirt and shorts, they were always damp. They never dried out, never got a chance. And sometimes the camps flooded, you were paddling about in mud. It was a horrible time as the monsoon period. But there we are, it came, it went, and you had to put up with it. Terrific thunderstorms during it at times. And I've never seen lightning like it in my life. But anyway, it started to slacken. By the time the cholera hit us badly.
What effect did the cholera have?
It was devastating, really. I mean, you know, there could be one of your mates not feeling too well in the morning when you went out to work, and he stayed in camp. When he came back at night, he was dead. As quick as that. And there were no burials. Every person who died was cremated on big bamboo fires not far outside the camp, you know. And the smell of that wasn't very nice either. And I was up there for 6 weeks, I think. 6 weeks. And in that 6 weeks, there were 76 deaths. And then the line was just about finished. So they started to decide to get the sick down country a bit. And I had a sick parade, and I was skin and bone by then. I'd only got weighed 7 stone. And the two, one look at me and put me on this. Of the boat party, and pal Tommy Denton, who used to get septic scabies due to malnutrition. You know, he had all his arms were all swollen up. And so the whole party of us went down to a barge, a motor barge, you know, and we headed off down the river. Never seen anything so nice as that damn camp vanishing behind us as we went down the river and turned a bend, and we'd lost it, you know. But we'd left a lot of friends up there, of course, and kept our fingers crossed for them. And we stopped overnight at, I couldn't say, one camp. And had a meal on the boat and slept, then carried on the next day, and we came to a camp called Tasso. I mentioned Group 4, working group. But Tasso was the base camp for Number 4 working group, just as Chun Kai was the base camp for our working group. And Tarso was as far as the railway had got at that time. So we were all ordered off the barge up into the camp. Well, it was still the tail end of the monsoon, you know. You got heavy showers every now and again, so the place was all mud. And there were no steps up this blooming bank. It was just a muddy bank, and you had to get yourselves up it. Well, as I say, Tom had a pair of arms, which are no bloody good, really. I had a pair of legs which weren't much use. So, switching it and hauling each other between us, we finally scrambled to the top of the bank, looking like nothing else on earth, mud up to the ears, you know. And we got up there. And we got a meal there. And then we were told we were going the rest of the journey on the train. And I think there were about 400 altogether, with the group four fellows who were going down sick as well on the train. And as I say, it was still tail end of the monsoon with showers any time. And sick men or not, we were all piled onto open flat trucks, the kind of things for hauling logs and things, you know. No sides, flat trucks. And set off into the night. Well, it'd be very warm during the day, but in contrast, it'd be damn chilly at night. And then the added effect, of course, of travelling on the train, although it didn't, never went terribly fast, but fast enough. And it was really an awful journey. It started to rain. But Tom had a blanket, and I say I had an old blanket. We'd been keeping dry, but we decided that rather than get pneumonia, we'd get our blankets wet. So we wrapped ourselves in the blankets and just sat there in this blooming rain, getting soaked. And then we crossed this bridge we'd built. Believe me, I was pleased to get across it. Because we knew what it was like, you know.
This is the one you'd built earlier.
And a big viaduct. We crawled across that with the thing sort of swaying a bit, and we got to the other side safely, fortunately, and carried on. And we got well down country, pitch black night, and the train pulled up, all men off. So we all got off. Sick men were carried off. And the Jap, who couldn't speak much English, you could only just, in the dark, make out a bit of a track. It was scrub country, low scrub country. You'd just make out this little bit of a track. And he pointed along this track and said, "Campo, all men, campo." And there were one or two officers with us, and they were here. How in the blazes can we get this lot in the dark? You know, we'll lose half of ourselves, we won't know where we are. And so we waited a while. Then one young officer came along. He said, "I'm fed up of sitting here, I'm not going to sit here all night. Is there anybody volunteer to form a small party with me? And we'll go along this track that the Nip pointed out, and see if we can find this camp." So Tom and I volunteered anything rather than sit there. And there was about six of us, I think, and this lad. We set off in the dark, just following this track. But then, of course, you got to the little tracks joining it. Which way did you go? So you just took a chance on it. And carried on, would walk like that for, and how far? We were all getting a bit tired, our legs were. So this officer said, "Look," he said, "the time's getting on, I think you had a watch." He said, "It'll be dawn before too long." He said, "I suggest that we just stop, sit down and have a rest. until dawn. Right, so we did. And then dawn approached, and somebody said, little light over there. A little flickering light. Another one over there. And these little flickering lights started to come up near us, you know. We're coming up all around. And as daybreak broke, we were sitting in the middle of a Thai kampong, a village. And who was the more surprised between us or the Thais or the looped out? I don't know. Because they didn't come and communicate with us much at all. Like other the chaps, you know, although there were none there, the chaps heard about it, they'd be in trouble. But it was their cooking fires that were lighting up. And they were doing their breakfast. So, after a while, kiddies came out with bowls, dashed across to us, put the bowls down and dashed back. And they had rice, yellow rice, purple rice, green rice, pink rice, every colour of the rainbow, from the herbs, you know. And hot, because, you know, chilies in them all, you know. And I had a terribly bad mouthful of ulcers at the time. And I said, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'm damned hungry. Whatever it does to my ulcers, I'm going to eat this stuff. So I started, we all got stuck into this rice. It was good as well, mind, but you could lit a cigarette from it. So hot. And my mouth burned and burned and burned. But anyway, we got through it and felt better for it. You know, it cleared up all my ulcers. I was pulled ulcer free after that. They were just burned out. And then we thought we'd better be getting on, so we just left the pole. We couldn't go carry them back. So we just walked through the canal and said thank you to everybody, gave them a wave and waved us back. Then we passed through the camp. We hadn't gone far when a squad of three or four big burly blokes with red crosses on their arms appeared. Where the devil are you from? Oh, some Tamarkan camp road, looking for the lot of you. Where on earth have you been? And that was the camp we were supposed to get to. And so they told us which way to go, and we told them roughly where the other lads were, and they set off to find them. So we arrived at this camp in the end. And the funny thing was, there was a lad on the party called George Cross. Now, George had been told that his brother had died up country, and he just flicked, you know. He was just went queer. And he was not fit, but he'd get around all right. And when we got there, he was the guard hut with his veranda in the front, and George sitting like my lord in a chair on the veranda. He was the only one that had got to the blooming camp all night. And of course the Japs were scared stiff of anybody who was a bit doolally, you know. The sins of their grandparents, their ancestors had been visited on them. So George was being treated fine because he realised what he was like. And there he was sitting there, you know. And we arrived one month after when all the others came. And that was the camp, Tamarkan, where Colonel Toosey was. You know? And the grub was, for those days, was good there.
What sort of things were you getting to eat there?
We got more meat, better vegetables, more rice. Just the same sort of idea, but more of it and better cooked because I had better facilities, you know, and definitely more of it.
How big was the camp, was it like?
Oh, how many were in it? You know, the talk about the bridge over the Kwai. which of course is pure fiction. But the Tamil, the Japs, the Thai, I don't blame them, they made a small fortune out of calling the Tamakan Bridge the bridge over the River Kwai. It's quite a big bridge that stretches over the river there. And that was the bridging camp for the lads who built it. And a lot of them, they were still there, of course. And they had better hospital facilities. And we were all shot in there and got checked with the medics and got a bit of treatment and one thing and another. And
what were the rest of the facilities like? Was it again just a tented
camp? Oh, just, no, it was huts. The bamboo had had up huts. But open latrines and all the rest of it, just like every other one. But it was kept pretty clean because they weren't working at the time. And Colonel Toosey, as I say, he wasn't a hard man at all, but he was an organiser and he kept things going well.
What was the morale of the men like by this time?
It was remarkably good, really. You know, when you were a bit fitter, when you got back down to a place like that where things were improving, I mean, morale, as you can imagine, up at the 211 camp was at the bottom, but just getting away from there lifted your morale a bit. And so we were there a week or two, and parties kept coming in. And a sequel, sad sequel, to something I said earlier about the lad with the bad dysentery who got left off the wagon when I was put on it. When Jackie arrived in the camp. And he was in a very bad way, poor lad. But we did what we could. He was in a different hut to us, but we used to go and visit him and see what we could do, and he was getting very, very, very weak. And I went along one evening and got to know the orderly, medical orderlies by then. And then I said, how is he? Oh, he's at Sarge's. I don't know whether he lost the night. So I went to him. I don't know whether he recognised me. I spoke to him. And I got up onto the bed slats beside him. He was having awful problems getting his breath, you know. And we got him raised up and I got underneath and got him resting against me so that he could keep up. Not like that for some time, and then he just literally died in my arms. You know, it was so strange that linkage between the truck incident a month or two before, and how he hung on, poor lad, the state he was in, I don't know. He was such a nice lad too. Local fella. He was territorial like the rest of us. And you know, we did what we could, but the doctors did as well. But he was too far gone, too weak, he couldn't fight any longer. And he just faded out. It was just tragic. But we were there for a number of weeks. And then we were moved back to Chun Kai, our base camp, which by that time was a great big camp. I think the one time I reckon it was about 10,000 in it or something of the sort. And that may be an exaggeration, but something like that, I believe.
Well, what sort of camp had it grown into by this time?
Well, just the same kind of camp extended, you know, these huts, same. And of course, it was the base camp, and it was a bigger hospital camp. They had a few more medical facilities and things, and they had a decent canteen organised, and they used the proceeds from the canteen to buy medical stuff from the Thais. And a Thai trader who had a name that long and finished up by just being known as Boon Pong, he's mentioned there. There's a special you know, done commemoration to him in that book. He used to get the stuff for us. He was the one trader who the Japanese trusted and allowed into the camp to do things. And he was a member of a free, they didn't know, a free Thai army who was undermining them as fast as they could go. He was supplying us with our fellows with batteries for illicit wireless sets and goodness knows what. That's why he got such a write up in there. He was a tremendous bloke with boon pong.
What other sorts of things was he trading?
Well, I wouldn't know really so much, because it was mainly, you know, even the wirelesses, we had a hint they were there, but we didn't know. You daren't let the Japs get them. So it was the officers who were running them, and my battery commander, Major McKenzie, and a couple of other blokes, they ran this wireless set. Now, if any of them had been caught, they would have been chopped, and that would have been it. So, you know that. But through the offices and boon pong, all sorts of extra medicines and things we got in, which is a big help, big help.
Did you get any news of how the war was going through these wireless sets? Or any other means?
Yes, but we always learned very much later for that reason. You know, it would be, well, the North African landing, for instance, and then the D-Day and these things, always just leaked out as rumours 3 or 4 weeks late, so that they didn't pinpoint these wireless sets, you know. They just had to play it that way. That's too dangerous otherwise. And so it was there that my bury really came to a head. My legs swelled up in the morning when I got up. My face was like a full moon, blown up. My body started to swell up. And I was put into hospital with it. And as it happened, a Jarrow doctor. Dr. Henry, oh, a lovely man, personality, you know, quiet, beautiful bedside man. He's actually a gynecologist and cesarean specialist. Because I know I used to be sick every morning, and one of our officers said, "Don't worry, Wade. He said, you know, you're under a cesarean specialist now, you'll be all right." So I went in there into his ward, and he examined me. And, you know, "We've got to get your stomach settled, Sergeant, and get, you know, this sickness and that stopped. And, of course, you know, we've got to get your fluid down." Because at night I had to sleep sitting up. I couldn't lie down while the fluid built up into my lungs, and I started to drown, in effect. And so he said, "What I'm going to do for a day or two, I'm going to put you on a fluid diet." Well, if anybody else had said to me that they were going to put me on a fluid diet with beriberi, I would have written my will out. Because some of the doctors who had been out there and were supposed to be well versed, or reasonably well versed, in medical, in tropical diseases and that, they were all against, you know. It was an absolute liquid free diet, a little drink of water a day or something, and slightly better grub if you could get it, but that was it. So I thought, good God, I'm putting me on a fluid diet. But that was the man. His personality was such that you had complete faith in him. You know, he was a charming man. And he said, "I'll tell you what it is." He said, "You know, we may be short on a lot of things, flush and wise, but he's got loads of soya beans. Now he said, soya beans are bung full of vitamin B. So he said, what I do, I get the kooks to boil them up, soften them, crush them, and it forms a sort of milk, and to give you the soya bean milk.